This is the Daily Crime Cast, number 43.
Hello.
Corey Mitchell?
Yes, sir.
This is Shane calling.
Hey, Shane, how are you, sir?
Good. You know, I didn't know if my phone was working, so is it bad that I called you?
No, not at all. I'm just here with the wife and the baby, so we were kind of getting everything fixed up with the little 2-month-old.
Oh, so you want to call me back?
No, I've got it all done, man. I'm good to go.
Oh, right on.
So how's it going, man?
Excellent. So we'll start the interview now.
Shoot, go right ahead.
Right on. Corey Mitchell, you're the author. The author
of... I am the awful author, that is correct.
of the book Evil Eyes.
That is correct.
Right on. So,
That's one of my books. That'll be my fourth book. Comes out this April 2006.
Which book?
Evil Eyes.
That's not out yet?
No, Evil Eyes will be out this April.
Okay, I'm trying to adjust my levels here so I can get your voice real nice. So Evil Eyes is out April 2006.
Yes, sir. That is correct.
All right. I was wondering about that.
Okay.
What's the next book you're working on?
I'm working, the tentative title right now is called Ego Maniac, and it's about a gentleman from Houston, Texas by the name of Anthony Allen Shore. Also goes by the name Tony Shore. And Tony Shore is a real lovely character. He molested both of his daughters and was given a slap on the wrist by the visiting judge in Texas. I was given a $500 fine and an 8-year probationary sentence, but no jail time. And then just a few years later, they discovered that he'd actually been killing lots of young girls and young teenage girls down in Houston, Texas. And just kind of started research on that one in earnest this past week. Traveled down to Houston to collect the court case files and to go out to all of the murder scenes as well as the residences where all the victims lived and also the residences of Tony Shore himself.
Yeah, he's definitely, I had started reading about that, and both cases that you're picking are in Texas because you're in Texas.
Correct. And my first book was Hollywood Death Scenes, and my second book, Dead and Buried, they're both set in California. I was actually living in California at the time, so that's an economic decision a lot of times, and it's also just the uniqueness of the cases that I like to pick. I lived in L.A. when I did Hollywood Death Scenes and Dead and Buried. The first book is set, obviously, in Hollywood, and then the second book was set in San Luis Obispo, California.
So which one was Dead and Buried? What's that about?
Dead and Buried is about another serial killer by the name of Rex Krebs from San Luis Obispo. It's actually kind of eerily similar to Tony Shore in that he was actually put in prison for rape. He had committed two or three rapes and was given a 20-year sentence but was released 10 years early. And subsequently, he escalated from becoming a serial rapist into a serial killer. He used to target the college women up in San Luis Obispo area, usually like 19 and 20-year-old, very attractive, thin, white women who were attending either Cal Poly University or Cuesta College, the local community college. And they found a couple of girls buried in his front yard. Actually, but he kind of lived out in the woods and in the canyons and everything, too. So he would kill these girls, rape them, or kidnap them, rape them. And that was another parole issue where somebody was released way too early.
Could you repeat what you just said? He killed them, raped them, and buried them in his front yard?
Yeah, he would kidnap them. Usually random. They would just be, like Rachel Newhouse, his first victim, was leaving a local Mexican cantina where there was a margarita festival that night, and she was a little tipsy, and she was walking back to her home in a nearby neighborhood, and he just basically spotted her, started to follow her, and then basically what he did was he climbed up this bridge and waited for her. It was a bridge that she would have to cross over from one section of town into her neighborhood. So it's almost like he knew she was going to be going there, and he waited up at the top of the bridge. Once she climbed up, staggered up the steps to the top of the bridge, and crossed over. He was sitting there in the shadows and literally picked her up off the ground and slammed her down head first repeatedly, and then dragged her, almost caveman-like, dragged her down the stairs, threw her in the back of his truck in the cab portion, and then took off with her while she was knocked out, and ran her off about 10 miles away up into this canyon house that he had, you know, completely secluded away from society. And then once he got them there, you know, exactly, he would kidnap them, he would rape them, and then he would strangle them, and then he buried Rachel Newhouse in his front yard.
So what's his kill count?
He is only officially tagged with two people, so the serial killing tag is questionable. There is some speculation that he might have killed more. I don't think that he really did, but it's just kind of the fascinating angle, the fact that this guy raped three women.
Do you really go with the tag of serial killers per the FBI's profile?
No, as a matter of fact, if you go in and you read most of my books, I tend to bag on the whole profiling concept. I think it's bogus.
Yeah, me too. Me and Joe from SK Central were in a mutual agreement at the same time when we were talking one time. Someone asked us how many kills it takes for a serial killer, and we said none, almost.
Right.
I mean, you have to actually kill to be a serial killer, but one kill could make a serial killer.
I think it's more the mentality in that, you know, would you be a recidivist killer, you know, if you had the chance to do it again? So
right, or maybe they have diaries planning more.
Yeah, exactly. You
their
know,
their rape kit or their kill kit.
Yeah, I think the whole, you know, I even back to my very first book, Hollywood Destinies, I totally slammed the whole concept of profiling in the serial killer section there. And it's just, to me, it's been a Hollywood creation by John Douglas and Robert Ressler and all these cool cats from FBI who, you know, they've marketed themselves successfully, and more power to them in that regard. But as far as it being a serial killer tool or hunting tool, it's completely worthless as far as I'm concerned. So,
and I would definitely agree with that. You know, I haven't read any of your books, which kills me to do the interview with you. I was very interested in your MySpace. Well, and I hope to speak with you in the future.
Oh, absolutely, man. And I'll be happy to have the publisher send you copies of my books, too. So.
Well, that would be cool, because then I could talk to you in detail about each one. So we're talking about, we were just talking about Dead and, what's the title again?
Well, let's see, from
the one that's out.
Go from the beginning, or?
No, the one that we just spoke about, the gentleman who raped and killed two women.
Yeah, Rex Krebs, and the book is titled Dead and Buried.
Dead and Buried, and then...
Yeah, that was my second book that came out in 2003. I actually made the Los Angeles Times bestseller list too. So,
well, my interest in you and why I wanted to interview you was because you're on MySpace.
Okay.
You're an author that's actively promoting themselves, and you've got this cool thing—a diary of how to make a true crime book and how to get published and all that.
Right.
And I thought that was really cool. How you're really working your books. You're really going out there to sell books and you're interactive with the public and interactive with kids that are interested, in, not just kids, but folks that are interested.
Yeah, my readership is really unusual. I get a lot of kids, you know, mainly young college students, but I tell you, my most devoted readership, fan base, if you will, is probably middle-aged housewives, who, you know, which is funny because they'll be the ones that will come out to see me at a book signing or a discussion.
Which is,
and then with MySpace, it's, you know, I've always been involved in pop culturist type stuff just for my own personal enjoyment, and I really find MySpace to be fascinating. First of all, the people that I've been able to reconnect with, from 15 years ago has been great.
Ain't that crazy?
Oh yeah, it's absolutely wonderful too. And then you know, you can go in and you can break down, you can do a search by what people like to read, and you know, I just track down a few people that like true crime books and send them requests or friend requests, and if they want to join, then they can you know, learn about my books. And yeah, as far as the diary of a true crime book, that's for the egomaniac book. That'll be my book on Tony Shore that we talked about.
Yeah, and ultimately your fan base, you say, like your general fan base, middle-aged housewives and younger folks on MySpace, that's basically the victims du jour of the people that you profile or you write about.
Yeah, it's...
So
it's,
you basically write to the victims.
Basically, yeah, exactly.
By doing that, do you think that's... You know, isn't that sort of ironic or maybe not? Maybe it's funny how the same victims, these middle-aged housewives or these younger girls, are attracted to these kind of books that are basically victimizing their profile or their...
I think the difference is, though, is that the women who actually go out and pick up these books and read the books put themselves in a better position of safety than the, you know, most of the women I've written about, they mm-hmm. never, you know, they don't, they're not into horror, they're not into true crime, you know, they're not into that particular genre. It seems like the women, you know, I'll go back to Denbury with Rex Krebs. My first wife, her name is Lisa Mitchell. She passed away 4 years ago unexpectedly, but she had been a rape victim as a 17-year-old girl, and that was a big part of the reason why I wrote that book to talk about, you know, Rex Krebs being a plural rapist and whatnot. And I've gotten so many letters. If you go back and you read the book, I put in there talk about my wife's unexpected death and how she had just started to come out of her shell 20 years later after her rape. And wanted to come out and start to speak to people about the rape and try to help women, but she never really got that chance. And I was hoping that Dead and Buried would be that opportunity for her to get that word out. And I've received more letters from rape victims for that book, just thanking me for writing that story and putting the word out about these guys.
I don't think rape's that special, and I don't mean it to be sound rude, but I think 9 out of 10 women are raped or molested.
It's horrible. You know,
I think that's just commonplace for women. You know, I mean, most of the girls I've known have been raped or molested or both.
Exactly. And, you know, it's just been so difficult for so many of these women to come out and talk about it and actually realize that they're not bad people, that, you know, they did not bring this on themselves, they're just horrible, unfortunate victims of unfortunate circumstances.
Or, you know, there's also, well, it's strange to talk about this now that I think about it, because I also have brought this issue up with, well, there's two things. I bring up the fact that the rape fantasy is women's, it's the top woman fantasy. Studied from, you know, Kinsey on down, it's the top woman fantasy. Okay, we're talking not the rape where you get your throat cut and your eyes gouged out, but we're talking about the friendly rape, okay, the fun man dominates the woman.
Yeah, I mean, but that's the difference is that it's fun and you know that it's a game. When my wife was kidnapped by two paint-sniffing high school dropouts and taken away from San Antonio, Texas to Corpus Christi, and then the FBI was brought in with helicopters and money drops, the whole bit, I don't think that was anybody's fantasy.
Oh,
then to have her first kiss
and
her first sexual inexperience to be raped by two guys over 3 days.
Oh, no, I'm saying the fantasy and reality are two different things.
Absolutely.
Okay, I'm not trying to say that was her fantasy. I'm just saying
I think it is very special and that it is very serious because, you know your background on serial killers. A lot of these guys escalate from sex crimes to taking it to the next level, too.
Yeah, and I think that's a perversion of our society almost. When I brought that up, I think it's strange that the victim profile is attracted to these kind of books and crimes. And when I've done some speaking engagements and done some stuff about true crime, I find a lot of women coming to these things that I'll do. And I feel there's almost a true crime has become very sexy. The only thing left that leaves the reality of true crime is the books that you're writing. Once it's made into a film, a TV show, A&E puts these biographies on, even the gentleman, the Evil Eyes gentleman you're writing about that will be out in April, you said?
Right, Coral Watts.
I just watched a special on him, and it didn't seem as grotesque as it actually is.
Well, you know, it's fascinating. I'll give you an example of the Tony Shore stuff that I just did this past week when I went to the Harris County Courthouse and went through the case files. You know, nothing really brings the case home more than seeing a picture of a 9-year-old girl with blood dripping from her vagina, with feces coming out of her anus, and her body, half of it burnt due to being out in the sun and baking for 14 hours. That's never going to make it onto CSI.
It's
in its full nasty glory. It's not going to be, even if it's in Seven or Silence of the Lambs, it's still going to be glossed over, quick cuts, flashy strobe lights, and sexy outfits and sweaty FBI people.
Exactly. And that kills me with that stuff, because when all my stuff, that stuff turns my stomach. And then when I see BTK and this guy, they're talking about how he gave the girl a cigarette before he killed her. He gave her a cigarette and a glass of water. Yeah, but he also put that cigarette out on her face like 13 times.
Yeah.
Never mentioned in any of the news reports.
No, not at all.
And they're selling vanilla, fat-free vanilla ice cream in between the CBS special on BTK.
Oh, yeah, man. It's all about selling shampoo and soap, you know.
Blows my mind. And the last...
As far as the Hollywoodization of serial killers, you know, just go on. I mean, I know you've seen this. Just go see Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer.
Beautiful.
Or, you know, that to me is really getting at the nasty grittiness of what's really going on. Or something like The Last Horror Movie.
Yeah, and Henry, they don't show any violence.
Right.
But the hearing of it is horrible. I cringed at, and I remember, I'm like, what the fuck am I cringing at? They're showing a piece of furniture, but you're hearing the woman scream and beg for her life. Oh God, that's horrible.
The camera pans around a dead body sitting down, but all you're hearing is the audio version of what had happened to it, and of course your mind just goes crazy figuring out what the hell went down with this too. So yeah, that's just a great. To me, that's more true than any of this other junk. That's CSI or Law and Order or Cold Case. Or, you know, there's just so many different things out there now that, like you said, trying to make it sexy. And my books are definitely not sexy.
Most of the true crime books that I pick up are The Last Hope. A lot of them are crap, though. I got to tell you. But that's the last. I'll find 1 out of 10, or maybe 2 out of 10, that have those gory details where you're like, "Fuck, I'm putting this down. I can't read this anymore."
Yeah.
And that's
It's I mean, everybody's going to have a different interpretation as to what a good book is, but to me, it's when I was in college, I was a DJ for my University of Texas radio station. I was the heavy metal, hardcore DJ back in the late 80s.
Yeah, right on.
I got quoted by the paper. They were talking about, 85% of the metal genre is crap, but if there's 15% of it, the diamonds in the rough that just stick out that are fantastic, and that make every, makes it completely worthwhile. And I think that's in any genre in writing, too, whether it's horror or if it's mystery or, if you like romance. I'm sure there's actually some decent romance authors out there.
Yeah, but we're talking two different apples and oranges. When you're writing a true crime book about facts, you're almost like supposed to be some sort of journalist where you're supposed to be middle of the road and present the facts, I think, sort of.
Yeah, that's exactly how I write. You can take a different tack, obviously, but you run the risk of showing your bias, which, everybody's got a bias. Some of my biases will slip through in my writing, but they tend to be more about bigger issues like overcrowded prisons due to first-time drug offenders filling them up. I tend to harp on that quite a bit. Like I said, I tend to harp on the anti-profiling of the FBI.
Beautiful. Both good things, but great points to bring up why there's drug health issues in prison. And criminals walk in the streets.
Absolutely. I mean, my good friend and mentor, Dennis McDougall, who's written several true crime books, including Angel of Darkness on Randy Kraft. One of his books, it's called In the Best of Families. It's about Ronald Reagan's tax attorney's son who kills his mother. And there's a whole discussion, it's a sub-issue about the fact that Reagan booted out all the people, from the mental institutions and booted them out into the streets, and what they were into, how the crime rates went up in California due to his policies.
Well, let's face it, the Republicans rule through fear, so.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
It just serves their purpose to turn a bunch of hardcore criminals out on the streets.
Yeah, exactly. So it keeps them in office year after year too. That's why Roe v. Wade will never be overturned, because they always need that to get the base out there to support their cause. So
I hope so, but that's a whole other subject.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you got to, okay. You got two books out, and we spoke about one. The other one is Hollywood Death Scenes.
Yeah, I actually have three books that have already been published. Hollywood Death Scenes, Dead and Buried, and Murdered Innocence, which was my last book.
What's Hollywood Death Scenes? Let's talk about that for a minute.
That was my first book that got me, first book I'd ever written. Got a top agent out of it. It got published, and what that is, I call it the true crime travelogue. It's basically all the extremely well-known cases in Los Angeles or the Los Angeles area, ranging anywhere from the Charles Manson case, the Night Stalker, the Hillside Stranglers, to celebrity suicides and celebrity homicides.
Oh, great.
Yeah, I've got mysterious cases like the John Holmes Wonderland case, the Marilyn Monroe.
So very tabloidy, as Hollywood is.
I'm sorry, say it again?
Very tabloidy, like Hollywood is.
Yeah, I don't know if you remember a show in the early 2000s. It was on E! It was the Hollywood Mysteries and Scandals.
Something like that.
A.J. Benza.
Okay.
It's kind of in that vein of those stories, but it's not as cheesy as that was. This is all still hardcore. I mean, this book has over 500 photographs in it. I have all the addresses of the actual death scene sites. That's the, hence the name Hollywood Death Scenes.
Good
so you
stuff.
Literally could take, and I've actually heard of people have written me that they've taken bus tours with my book in hand to do their own death scenes tours out there.
Well, on my own, I don't have the book, but on my own I've done a lot of those tours, so.
Yeah.
They're good tours.
Oh, yeah. When I moved to California in 1997 from Texas, and, I'd always been fascinated by Helter Skelter and the Charles Manson case, but literally the first weekend there I went and did my own little Charles Manson tour. And it just completely changed how I viewed that book, from the old black and white photos in the book to actually going to seeing these ritzy, badass mansions. And Spawn Ranch is gorgeous. It's like, how in the world could these guys want to kill? You got all these chicks, all the naked girls you want, all the drugs you want. You're not that far from the beach. You got mountains and horses. Why would you want to go kill people? So it just really brought a different perspective to me on the case. So that was really great, and that motivated me to start researching like crazy.
Well, at least their stuff is somewhat politically based, or so they say. My Dean Corll. What?
You talking about Manson?
Yeah.
That's interesting. I don't know how much of it was politics or how much it was just trying to get laid.
With the killings?
No, I'm just talking about the whole concept of the family.
Oh, yeah, well, I'm sure that was all about getting laid, but
I don't know. I don't really postulate my theory completely, but in the book and Hollywood Death Scenes, but I think it was more of our boy Bobby Busley killing Gary Hinman, doing a cover-up on that. I almost think it was more to cover up, to try to get his butt for being thrown in jail, or to prove that he shouldn't be in jail.
Yeah, but I mean,
that's the race riots, and the blacks are going to hide in the earth. I mean, the whites are going to hide in the earth, and the blacks are going to have this huge race riot and kill each other, and Charlie's going to come up and rise to the top.
Yeah, but that's a long way from, I think a lot of that, there's circumstances and situations, and I think to want to help out a friend and to be in an era where you're having hundreds or thousands of people killed in Vietnam, and that whole outcome of what you're being surrounded by his death every day in the news, that whole hippie movement, I think that had something to do with it too. They're political,
I think it's definitely part of the backdrop now, but when it comes to Charlie and him, obviously I'm just speculating, but I think it has more to do with covering up for Busley and also the whole Terry Melcher, snubbing him with the potential record contract or production deal.
Yeah.
I think that has something almost, it's almost more just a little revenge fantasy, and it just so happened to be that Sharon Tate, of all people, and Abigail Folger of the Folger Coffee, heiress, happened to be there. And if it hadn't been those people, it would have been, wow, it was really gruesome killing, but they would have forgot about it 2 or 3 days later.
Sure, I think it has a little to do with both. I think it was just I think it has a little to do with all those combinations.
Yeah, I think Manson's state of mind is probably shaped exactly like you're saying by, not only the whole Vietnam era, but also his prison time. And
sure.
You know, that whole mentality of all of a sudden, you know, you spend half your life in prison, and now you're able to bang all these chicks and do all the drugs you want, and then, you know, combine that in this whole pot of anger and frustration and this frustration with the music. You know,
violence gets violence, man.
Yeah. And honestly, I tell you, the worst guy of that whole group is Tex Watson.
Oh, yeah.
And nobody.
He was stupid.
Yeah. You know, I mean, you talk about, I mean, you know Manson's not a killer. He's not a serial killer. But I tell you, you know, Charlie, Tex Watson sure as hell is. And so is Patricia Krenwinkel. You know, I mean, people don't really go off on them that much. So I find that fascinating, too. I'd like to actually do a book on Patricia Krenwinkel because she's the only Manson key family member that was at the murders that there hasn't been a book written about, too. So
why aren't you?
You just, you know, got contractual obligations. I'm taking care of these books right now, so
okay.
I'd love to do one on her, though, eventually.
So the third book that you have on bookshelves, what's that called?
My third book is entitled Murdered Innocence.
Okay, and what's that about?
That came out last year, and it's about the Texas yogurt shop murder.
Oh, wow, man, I've got a great... Oh, fuck, you're kidding me. You ever hear the Fuck Emos?
Dude, I write about the Fuck Emos in my book.
Oh, because they have that song?
Song Y.M., yeah.
Have you heard it?
I talked to Russell.
Have you heard the song?
Oh, yeah, dude. I talked to Russell. You know,
you know, he gave me that song. It's funny that we're talking then. I was the first person to hear that song outside the band. He gave me that for a release of mine that we were putting out, a mini comic with that. So that's funny.
That's awesome. Yeah, dude. I talked to Russell while I was writing the book, and, you know, I'd already heard the song quite... I lived in Austin when the murders actually occurred and was actually in the music industry also, so, you know, obviously he had heard all the stuff about the people in black where they thought it was a bunch of goth kids that had committed the killings and so forth. So, yeah, it's that was a book I had to write, you know, just because I lived there at the time of the murders.
I fucking love Austin.
It's a fantastic town, man.
Hey, man, I saw you have a link on your website to a Texas radio station.
Is that... Probably so, which...
Oh, no, I thought you did. I just was wondering.
I haven't, you know, ever since I got on MySpace, I don't even update my own personal website anymore, I tell you, man. It's,
Well, let me plug you into a kick-ass Austin station. Metal, punk, fuck emos. Chaos959.com.
959?
Yeah, .com. They're like pirate radio. They're best, man. Best fucking radio I've ever heard.
Awesome, man. No, I'll definitely check it out.
KAOS959.com.
KAOS. Chaos.
Yeah, 959.com.
Cool. Yeah, totally, man.
Best thing you'll ever hear.
I was the metal DJ from 88 to 90 at UT.
Yeah, so that's what I'm saying. You'll be stoked when you hear this, dude. You'll be way stoked. I mean, you'll tune in, you'll hear I Hate God, then Nuclear Assault, then Motley Crue, Shout the Devil, then you'll hear punk rock, you know, that's great, man. It's just a great, you know, country and western, they just are great.
That's awesome, man. No, that's fantastic. So,
sorry to get off, I love Austin, so.
It's okay, man. Well, that's, you know, that's why I wanted to do the yogurt shop book, because, you know, I love Austin, too. You know, I lived there for 8 years, and then during school, and then... You know, now I live in San Antonio, right down the street, so I was able to travel to Austin and go, you know, see all my buds and everything and hang out with my friends. And then, I mean, it really is part of what's attractive to a book. It's, the town I'm going to be spending time in, am I going to enjoy being there?
So what did Russell have to say in the book? What did you get him to say? What happened?
I don't even remember. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't really important. It was just talking about the song. I don't remember the exact quote or anything, but I think it was just about the fact that, you know, they had been harassed by the cops a bit, and people were wanting to know why they'd sing the song, and, you know, what did they know about it, and were there other bands involved? But
right,
it was just
right
a small,
on.
It was just a small, like, one paragraph bit
hey,
in the whole book. So.
With a rock god like Russell from the Fuck Emos, that one sentence is worth a million words.
But, yeah, man, that was a... I actually think that's, I mean, you know, I feel like a musician, you know, oh, this album is my best ever, but I've kind of felt like I've done that same trajectory where each book I've gotten a lot better at writing. I really like, you know, what I put in each book better and better each time. And, yeah, I love Murdered Innocence. I thought it was a great, great story. Just really powerful with the four girls being murdered and then the case going unsolved for 8 years. And then these young guys who are the same age as the girls at the time of the murder supposedly confessed to it, but there's a lot of question about police corruption. Did they coerce confessions? It's a great mystery. And
so did anyone ever get caught for it?
Yeah, actually, in 1999, there were four guys who, like I said, they were the same age as the girls at the time of the murders. And they confessed to them. And there's a whole lot of speculation by a lot of people that, we think the cops were threatening these guys and, probably trying to beat it out of them and so on and so forth, that they were feeding them information and all. But I've seen all the confession tapes, and I don't have any doubt that two of the guys are definitely, the two guys who are now, one's in prison for life and the other one's on death row here in Texas, I have no doubt that they did it. So
yeah, that bullshit about cops beating you in confession. You know what? I get in trouble, they can beat the shit out of me, rape me with the broomstick. I ain't admitting. I don't give a fuck.
Exactly, man. If you didn't do it, you're not going to admit it. I mean, I do talk about the psychology of interrogation and threats and so forth, but for me, and that's kind of like you're saying earlier, lay out the facts, let the readers make the call themselves. But, my personal belief is that if you didn't do something that horrendous and that horrible, you're probably not going to confess to it. So
the only place I believe that is not true is probably that West Memphis 3.
Yeah, I don't follow that case that much. I mean, obviously, like most other people, when Paradise Lost came out, the first one I thought was fantastic and really made me question, the validity of the convictions in that case. But then a good friend of mine, an author, her name is Dana Holliday. She's passed away just in the last year. She wrote Zodiac of Death with Don Lasseter, another true crime book. She had read this, I guess the first book on the West Memphis 3 came out before the documentary, and she had told me that the book was actually, it really made it seem like the guys did it. So I went, that's kind of cool. I didn't read the book. Well, then Paradise Lost 2 came out, and I thought that was horrible. I thought that was just a crappy documentary, the whole, my friend Danny used to call the profiler the baggy pants profiler. It seemed like this guy, I don't even know who the guy is, but it seemed like, he got his profiling certificate from a, 7-Eleven or something, and he could all of a sudden go out and profile exactly what happened in this case and who did the killings and so on and so forth. So, I'm up in the air on the case. I only say that because I just don't know enough about the facts to really have a strong opinion one way or the other.
But, yeah, there's some things I don't think you need to know a lot about. I don't think kids like that are going to cut out someone's genitalia like that. This is weird.
I don't know, man.
The psychology of it all smacks that.
We're freaking sick, man. I mean, all ages are sick, man. So,
but the psychology.
I don't put anything past anybody, man.
That's true, but the psychology of it smacks that dad doing it or whatever. It just does. I don't know. Probably.
No, it definitely, at the same time, then you have to question Berlanger and the other guy, the directors, what was their motivation. And that's why it lost a lot of its glamour for me in the second one, because the directors became part of the story.
Yeah, I don't care about TV, though. See, I hate TV. So yeah. I read on my own. I read a bunch of articles. I got out and read some books about it. And I just, I believe, I don't trust anyone. You're right. I'm wrong to say those kids shouldn't do it, but
question I would pose to you then, though, is that, and I'm just, like I said, I'm not as familiar with the case, though. I know there's been at least two books that have come out on the case since the Paradise Lost documentary, so, are the writers of those books also sympathizing with what they saw in the documentary? Because the vast majority of people out there know about that case because of those documentaries.
Yeah, I've only read the news articles that have come out in their local papers.
That's cool.
I did searches from the time that they were arrested to read like that. That's where I see I'm going to get my most truths from.
Yeah. Oh, I agree with that. Absolutely.
So that's where when I want to dig into something, I fucking fuck off your book or their book or anyone's book. I go in to get the news articles.
Yeah.
Now, that's where I want to read about things. And so that's where I just feel like there's something weird about that whole thing. There's just something odd, man. I don't know, but whatever. I mean, I'm probably
wrong. Sure. No, it's a fascinating, fascinating case, absolutely.
My problem is I'm predisposed to have sympathy for the Satanist, the occultist, the metalhead, the kid in black.
Outcast, man. Well, then you'll love Murder and Innocence because the whole raking over the coals of the God Kids, or the PIBs, as they call them, the people in black.
You know what? On the books that are published, we'll have to do a... You know, I'd like to interview you when I get the books, about each book specifically, so I can talk about, you know what I'm talking about.
Absolutely, man. Anytime. I'd be more than happy to talk with you about it, too.
Cool.
Let me get your address, Shane, and I'll...
All right, when we're done with this, because we're on the... This is going to be like a radio show.
Cool.
Interview. So when we're done, I'll hang up and I'll exchange an info with you. But Dean Coral Watts, I didn't know who he was. And then right as I'm asking you for an interview, and the interview was based on your MySpace stuff, how open you were, how I go, man, this guy's cool for a true crime author. I don't know if I like a lot of true crime authors. You know, be honest. And I read a little bit of how you were writing, and it seemed like you were seemed like you're honest and have a journalistic edge to things. So I wanted to talk to you about that kind of stuff. And then I saw this special on Dean Coral Watts on A&E, and I was shocked because I did an interview with Andy Kahn.
Right.
Okay, and he was boasting about what he did for Dean Coral Watts, and I said, whatever, Andy. I don't give a fuck. What you're doing with eBay is wrong. You know, and I'm arguing with him on that stuff.
Right.
And so, but Dean Coral Watts is freaking me the fuck out because, okay, I can understand, I don't mean to sound weird, but I can understand a rapist. Because they're raping and killing.
Right.
So they're satisfying that. But this Dean Coral Watts just grabbed women and cut their throat and killed them and walked away, right?
That's one of the many methods that he did, actually.
But he didn't rape.
Correct.
He didn't steal.
That's not true.
He did steal.
That's what they try to portray it as. It's a total drive-by stabbing, which that did happen a couple of times. And just let me clarify one thing before I start going into that. His name is actually Coral Eugene Watts.
Oh, Dean. Okay.
And then, you know, Dean Coral was also in Houston at... you know, several years earlier, too.
Oh, boy,
so
you know...
A lot of people will get those confused, but it's Coral Eugene Watts.
Coral Eugene Watts, and you know what, man? It's called smoke damage from the early metal days, okay? Could you hold on 1 second?
Not a problem, okay, man.
You've been listening to the Daily Crime Cast. Housed at crimeandcookies.com. Three fine podcasts all rolled into one website.